I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. There used to be pretty hard and fast rules and traditional rituals about how to mourn the death of a loved one. It also used to be a relatively private experience shared with family and friends. But in recent years, people, especially younger generations, are making the grieving experience much more personal and much more public through the funeral service itself and through the use of social media. So today in Radio Times, we want to talk about memorializing our loved ones in new and different ways. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Caleb Wild is a sixth-generation licensed and practicing funeral director and embalmer, works in Chester County, just outside of Philadelphia. He's currently working on a postgrad degree studying the intersection of death, religion, and culture, and he authors the blog Confessions of a Funeral Director. Caleb Wild, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And also with us is Rebecca Sofer, and she's co-founder and CEO of the website Modern Loss, which features candid essays and resources about loss and grief. In fact, she wrote about the loss and grief that she had with her family as well. And speaking of mourning, former producer of the Colbert Report, and I am in mourning because that show is going to be going away. Rebecca, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Marty.
You're very welcome. And Caleb, I do want to begin with you because you are a sixth-generation funeral director, and I have a feeling that does run in families. But I'm also curious about what you see as the most dramatic difference in recent years or even maybe even recent months.
Yeah, I think the basic underlying principle with how funerals will change, we want to reflect our death styles with our lifestyles. And so as globalization takes place and as we see a lot of changes through social media, we get exposed to many different things. And I think also as our consciousness towards the environment continues to rise, we're seeing a large shift in how our lifestyles have changed. And the funeral industry is generally about 20 to 30 years behind because the people who are using our services are older and so forth. So as we continue to age and as my demographic, my age population continues to age, I think we're going to see a lot of shifts with how death styles reflect our lifestyles.
Let me turn to you, Rebecca. And you wrote about the death of your parents. I mean, that was something you did a couple of years ago, a way to express the kind of mourning feelings of grief that you had.
Yeah. Well, I lost my not according to my plan. I lost both of my parents in my early 30s. My mom died in a car accident when I was 30. My dad died 4 years later. And it was to say the least, a total shock. I wasn't expecting it. And it took me a while, actually, to write about it because I think inherently this day and age when you're I wasn't an adolescent going through loss, but I was still relatively young. I was 30 and I had all these huge milestones ahead of me. And all of a sudden, the foundation of my life was ripped out from underneath my feet. So it really left me scrambling for, who is my team? Who is my support system to get me through this? And I found that there really isn't a lot, or there wasn't a lot to turn to. I really had to create it myself. And part of creating it was also realizing that by writing about it, I was taking ownership of my reality, and I was kind of crafting my own narrative and not having people craft it for me.
And I want to pick up on that. What I find so interesting, because I'm probably the next generation ahead of you, is that when you get to be in your 60s, 70s, you get used to people dying. I mean, it's just, it truly is a fact of life. But as you're saying, here you were in your 30s and probably this, and especially someone getting killed in a car accident. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it was
something just coming completely out of left field, so to speak.
Totally out of left field. And, as I said, I was single. I had all these dreams. I wanted to get married. I wanted to get a mortgage. I wanted to get a dog and have babies. And all of a sudden I was faced with those dreams and not knowing how I would achieve them without my main support, which were my parents. I mean, I have plenty of friends and family, but they were the nucleus of my life, and all of a sudden they vanished. And it's a very disconcerting feeling to feel like you're free-floating through the universe as a young adult. And I am defining 30 as being a young adult.
Indeed.
And having nothing before and nothing after.
So how was it helpful for you to write? As you said, it took you time.
Yes. Yeah.
But how did it help you? I mean, is it like talking to somebody in a way, sharing?
It is. It is like talking to somebody. It's like talking to somebody who isn't going to interrupt you or assure you that they know what you're going through, or just put their hand on your shoulder and tell you it takes a year. It's like talking to somebody who's going to be politely quiet until you're done saying what you have to say, and also let you take the time to process what it is you're really feeling. And I think that, you know, these days we're bombarded by pings and dings. We don't actually have the luxury of taking time to figure out what our headspace is. So writing is very, very therapeutic, but as you said, you know, it took me years. It's not like I immediately turned the page for therapy.
Well, let me turn to you, Caleb. And this is maybe an advice kind of question, but for people that have lost a loved one or are dealing with the sort of shock of the death of a loved one, it is often common for people to say, this will get better. Don't feel what you're feeling. What do you suggest people do?
Yeah, I don't know if it ever gets
better. I guess how
better.
Honest should people be?
Honesty goes a long way, especially when it comes to grief. Grief is such a communal thing. There's an axiom that I like to say, grief shared is grief diminished. So the more that we're able to be transparent, the more that we're able to share what's going on. And death is such a in fact, it's one of the few universals. You know, all the relativity we see from culture to culture. And as all of that's being mashed together right now through social media and globalization, death is one of the few shared experiences where we can all relate with anybody. So to be able to share those experiences is a huge healthy part in being able to find healthy grief. You know, I don't think grief will ever end, and we shouldn't attempt to seek a completion. You know, it's not something that
I hate that word closure.
Yeah, it is.
Or it doesn't
should
exist.
Banish it.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
Yeah. And the five stages of grief, you know, it was never meant to apply to somebody who's dealing with death. It was meant to apply to people who are realizing their own mortality and in a terminal state. So there is no end to these stages. That's something that's circular, and it comes and goes, and it's a part of who we are now. So transparency is a huge thing, and I think social media is a fantastic way to develop the conversation. It provides us with other people who may, you know, a tragic loss, a car accident.
Sure.
We might not know anybody who has experienced the death of a loved one through a tragic car accident, but on social media we might be able to find somebody, and then we'll be able to relate our experiences and hold hands, so to speak, through Facebook, etc.
And Rebecca, what did you want as you were sort of dealing with the sort of early parts of your grief and loss and mourning? What did you want from friends and family?
I wanted something that I wasn't able to put into words, and that was the problem. I was in such a shock from such a sudden loss with my mother, and then eventually my father, after which I realized I was an orphan, which was kind of comical to me because I always picture, like, please, Sam, I have some more.
Right.
And I was looking in the mirror. I'm like, I don't look like Oliver, but I'm an orphan. So I was like, I don't know anybody who's an orphan who's 34 years old. I just wanted to implant a microchip into everybody around me for 2 seconds so that they understood what it felt like, because I didn't have the energy, the stamina, you know, the wherewithal to explain it over and over again. And also, by extension, every day was different. So I certainly didn't have the energy. So what I ended up doing was kind of retreating a bit, because I was surrounded by amazing friends. I have the best friends in the world. But most of the time, they had absolutely no idea what to do for me, because I didn't know what I needed. And I realized I would go on these like online searches, just searching for an outlet that got me. And I'd find these like really gently flickering e-candles, or like, you know, these like legacy pages that actually somehow had haze, you know, it was like a heavy filter online, or really religious sites, which is fine. And some of them were quite profound, but didn't really speak to me as somebody who, you know, I'm a TV producer. I'm a journalist. And I just wanted something that was kind of tongue-in-cheek, very candid, and alluded to the fact that, you know what? What you're going through is, it has a long arc. Like Caleb said, it's not something that you get through. Mm-hmm. It's that you get over. You move on with it, and you live with it in different iterations throughout your entire life. And I just wanted to read that there was somebody else out there that was living this crazy mess. And by extension, as you say, grief shared is grief diminished. That's what I was hoping for.
And did you find it?
No, I did not. I did. Well, I found it in different ways. It was always kind of a serendipitous experience. You know, I'd read an essay in the back of the New York Times magazine about the relation, you know, how a man walking down the grocery store aisle was triggered, you know, had a memory triggered about his dead father and the connection between food and memory and loss. And I would be very moved because the same thing happened when I picked up a bottle of Aunt Jemima at A&P, you know, and I was wondering if I'm the only one that happened to. But it was always a very isolated experience online. And so, you know, Modern Loss was born of that, which was there are incredible sites out there. I'm certainly not reinventing the wheel. But what I wanted was kind of, and my co-founder, Gabby Berkner, wanted was a one-stop place where you could get these really original stories focusing on very narrow aspects of a person's experience with grief, along with very practical resources. We have an advice column. We have, you know, legal, financial, therapeutic resources that you just don't have the energy to search for when you're in the thick of it.
Well, you said make sure when in describing Modern Loss to use the word candid.
Yes.
It's important to say it's these and being honest sometimes is tricky or can be hurtful even.
Absolutely. But you know what? Being honest, I can't tell you how many emails we have gotten from people saying, wow, I thought I was the only person who found out that their dead husband was cheating on them. I can't believe there's someone else out there that this happened to. Or, you know, I thought I was the only one that, you know, was the last person to find out that my dad died because Facebook found out before I did because I was out of service. And you know what? Yeah, that is tricky. Yeah. And it is uncomfortable. And it's super messy. But guess what? Talking about death and grief is super taboo in this culture. And I don't know why. And if we don't, you know, pull the curtain back on this type of discussion, we're not going to get anywhere as a society because the news flashes. This is going to happen to all of us.
Absolutely. Well, and you know that probably better than anybody, Caleb.
10 out of 10. Yep. Yes. And I think that the funeral industry is partially to bear the responsibility for our death denial in culture in America. I think what we've done is we have taken over a lot of the responsibilities that should be to the primary caregivers, the families. And the industrialization and the professionalization of death care, unfortunately, in our best intentions, have made the discussion something that – or the practice of death care something that should only be done in those in the professional community.
Oh, interesting. I want to pick up on all of that and also get our third guest into the conversation. We're talking in this hour of Radio Times about evolving rituals about death and loss, talking with Caleb Wilde, Rebecca Soffer, and also talking with Megan O'Rourke after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about something that doesn't get talked about quite very much, I should say, and that is the fact that we're all going to die and we're all going to deal with death and loss. And again, Caleb Wilde is a sixth-generation licensed and practicing funeral director and embalmer. Rebecca Soffer, co-founder and CEO of the website Modern Loss. And joining us now is Megan O'Rourke. She's the author of a book called A Long Goodbye, a memoir about the death of her mother. And Megan O'Rourke, I know you were listening in, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Very happy to have you here as well. And we were talking about just sort of the difficulty, I guess, of sharing or even knowing what one is experiencing when one has lost a loved one. And in your book, it's really about your mother's protracted death and this long goodbye. What was that like for you? I know it's such a crass question to ask, but let's start there.
It's not something I can summarize quickly. It took a book, I guess, to try to describe that. But what I was really struck by in the aftermath of my mother's death, much of the book is actually not about her death, but about the aftermath, about grief, and that the grief itself is part of the long goodbye. And what really struck me, and your guests have been touching on this, is just how our culture really doesn't know how to grieve, and that the kind of old communal rituals that used to support us in our grief have really disappeared. And as problematic as those rituals sometimes were, they served a function. You know, they reminded us of the communal aspect of grief and the fact that though each of our griefs is incredibly individual, grief itself is, as you've been saying, kind of the one universal. And so I wrote the book to try to animate what I was thinking of as the lived experience of loss and to try to build a bridge between the mourner, who feels very isolated in her grief, often feels very isolated, and those around her who maybe do want to support her and connect her but don't know how to.
And that's always the trick, which is sort of what to say and how to say it and what are the words and what are the actions that someone must do. Going back to you, something that you wrote, Megan, you said nothing prepared me for the loss of my mother. And this was something that Rebecca was talking about. Even knowing that she would die did not prepare me. A mother, after all, is your entry into the world. She's the shell in which you divide and become a life. Waking up in a world without her is like waking up in a world without a sky. Unimaginable. Does it become more imaginable over time?
You know, it both does and doesn't. And I think that this is one of the things about grief that we don't understand until we go through it, and that, you know, hopefully sites like Modern Loss are helping us understand more, which is that grief is not this linear thing that slowly abates over time. It's actually very cyclical. It's kind of like the ocean, right? These tides rise up and recede and rise up and recede. And so while one does really get used to a world without a mother, there are certainly these moments for me where it's cracks open, and I, you know, seems incredibly strange that I can't call my mother on the phone and tell her, you know, there are certain jokes that only she would really, and, you know, certain funny things happen that I know she would really enjoy, and it's difficult, right? So it's a recurrent experience, that anytime something new happens, anytime something really difficult happens, we often want to connect to that person who we've lost and to the self we were with them.
And you're nodding your head, Rebecca, as Megan is talking.
Vigorously.
You can relate to that.
Yeah. I mean, well, Megan, I'm a tremendous fan of yours. And, you know, everything you put into writing, I pretty much nod my head with. I think that I was shocked that this culture, you know, it was a shock to me that my mom wasn't with me. And, you know, I played that game. Would it have been easier had I been able to say a goodbye? Had I been able to say everything that, you know, I didn't get to say? And I realized that's just a game. It's a cruel game you play with yourself. And the only thing that you can eventually do is embrace the reality, which is the phrase, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the only thing that's enabled me to move on and live a very full life. I mean, I'm completely bowled over that I have as full a life as I have today with, you know, married, you know, apartment, new website, baby, labradoodle. I would have sworn to God that I wouldn't have had any of those things after I lost her, because, as you say, it's unimaginable a world without her. And also, to touch on what you say, is it being cyclical? It's grief. It's the long arc of grief. And I don't necessarily think of myself as somebody who's grieving every day, but I define myself as somebody who is living with loss.
Right.
And because you do, and it informs all of your decisions, even if you don't realize it. And I think that, you know, the more that we can talk about the triggers that arise expectedly and unexpectedly, and inform people that, you know, it's not the expected thing. It's not just your wedding day is going to be hard, or the day that you move into a new apartment. It's going to be like Thursday night when you're watching the Kardashians and you wish you could call your mom and like talk about like Kim and what a schmuck she is or whatever. And I think that the more people realize that, maybe the more empathic our culture can become.
Not just missing Thanksgiving, which I'm thinking, exactly. You know, the day that we're coming up on, but you're laughing, not sharing something from,
no,
you know, TV.
She's funny.
Yes. Well, and if I can go back to you, Megan, because something else you wrote about an absence becomes presence. And I guess that's one way of kind of reconciling this loss. We were saying none of us like the word closure, but just that this absence becomes a kind of presence in your life.
Yeah, I'm with you on the closure front. I mean, it's far too tidy a summary of what grief is. And this is my problem also with the five stages, which, by the way, clinical research shows that we don't go through five stages, even whether it's as you're approaching death or as you're grieving. But anyway, the absence becomes a presence. A metaphor that really sprung to mind after my mother died was that, you know, living with grief wasn't like an amputation, which was something I'd heard a lot, although it can have those qualities. But it's like, you know, those moments, especially when you're in a city where you see a tree that's grown around an obstacle, you know, and its whole growth has been shaped by something that's in its way or that's constricting it. And I really think that for me is what grief is, you know, that the rest of my life, the rest of my family's life, you know, is shaped by this absence. It's absolutely a presence in our lives. And there are days where we can all really deal with that. And there are days when it's hard.
Does that make sense to you, Caleb, what we're talking about here?
Yeah, certainly. Thankfully, I haven't experienced any personal loss. I've lost some grandparents and so forth. But it's definitely something that, you know, we see the initial, I guess I should say we have the privilege entrusted to us of seeing people in their most vulnerable moments and seeing them confronted with the reality of the situation, you know, at our funeral home,
yeah,
or if we go into their home because of hospice and so forth. You know, it's certainly a heavy task.
Well, let me just share something, because I have lost numbers of members of my family. And I have to say, at funerals, I have cried, but I have also laughed my head off.
Sure.
Like I'm in third grade again.
Yeah.
And maybe it is being vulnerable or for at least that hour or two connecting people that are sharing the same thing. But I can't tell you how many times we just like fallen out of our chairs laughing about something.
It's certainly it's a healthy coping mechanism. And it's interesting because I was reading an encyclopedia of death the other day, which only funeral directors have in their library. This is the 4-volume edition, but they had a whole section on humor and death and how oftentimes poets, and that they trace different poems and so forth and short stories. It took up a couple pages of an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
How different poets have coped with death through humor. And it certainly is a great way to release some of the tension that's building up in our bodies.
Can you relate to that, Tammy? Rebecca, excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, you have to laugh. If you can't laugh, then, like, you've got nothing, you know? Laughter gets you through everything, the darkest times, even if it gets you, barely pushes you through the door. I mean, one of my favorite anecdotes is a friend of mine who experienced a deep loss, and at the cemetery, they were lowering the coffin into the ground, and everybody was very kind of somber. Obviously, it was like wintry day, like very Dickensian, and the thud, you know, of the coffin on the ground, and all of a sudden, someone's yarmulke blew off, a gust of wind came and like it swirled it around, and then it like landed on the coffin 6 feet down, and everybody was kind of like, and then all of a sudden someone broke the ice and said, "Damn, that was real leather," and everybody just
the yarmulke was real leather,
and like
down
just,
the hole, right?
Yeah, right, there it goes. And you know, you just have to laugh, and like that's a very like immediate post-death, you know, humor experience.
You can't plan
but,
that one,
you know,
right?
I'm sure that all of us here have coped. I mean, I cope every single day with laughing about it, and not just laughing, but like being upset, being annoyed, that angry with her that she's not here. It's that you talk about trigger days, and Megan talk about this cyclical nature of grief. I mean, this week, I'm telling you, I am a mixture of very sad and really pissed off that my mom is not here for Thanksgiving to meet my first child, who's still a baby, you know?
That's Rebecca Sofer. She's co-founder, CEO of the website called Modern Loss. Also with us, Megan O'Rourke. She's the author of a memoir called A Long Goodbye. And Caleb Wild, sixth-generation licensed and practicing funeral director and embalmer, has a practice in Chester County outside of Philadelphia. Well, it may be that people don't like to talk about death and dying, but we clearly have a lot of people that want to join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can put a comment on our Facebook page as well. I see that as well. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get, looks like Terry from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. Terry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, friends. Morning. Thanks for a great conversation.
Thanks.
One of the, I'm what they call a death midwife. The other term is a home funeral educator. And, you know, what most people don't realize is that they have the right to act as the funeral director for their loved ones after they die. It's not necessary. You're not legally required to turn your dead loved one over to a professional funeral director. It's legal in all 50 states, although in 9 states, some degree of funeral director involvement is required. And, you know, one of the most important things I like to remind people is a dead body is not an emergency. I mean, it's kind of like anything but, right? Like, all emergency action can now stop. And caring for your dead at home is an incredibly meaningful, deeply healing, beautiful opportunity to actually be invested in this grieving process. As, you know, the outcome for grief is always better in these populations that care for their own dead. And it's a very, it's a movement that's gaining popularity. There's an organization, the National Home Funeral Alliance, and we now have over 500 members. And well, all of us do nothing but help other people learn how to care for their own dead.
Well, Terry, I appreciate the call. Let me give you a chance, Caleb, to respond to her comments.
I totally agree. I think the professionalization, as I had mentioned before, and the industrialization of death care has hurt our ability to embrace death. When the funeral industry takes responsibility for a lot of these things, it takes that responsibility away from those who should have it, which is the immediate family. And I'm a big proponent of home funerals and green burials. And I think, as I talked about earlier, how death care needs to reflect – I mean, death style needs to reflect lifestyle. As we continue to become more environmentally conscious, I think we need to start learning how to reflect that in our death style. And it's slowly becoming popular, although it's a difficult thing to do because we feel as though we don't have any background in it. But the reality is that love is one of the main qualifiers for us caring for our dead. And if we have that, we can do it. I think it's a fantastic thing, and I believe that funeral directors need to stop seeing themselves so much as directors and more so as teachers.
You were saying during the break, Rebecca, that you were not happy with the funerals for your parents.
No.
I don't know if happy was the
right
word.
Sorry, funeral parlors in northeast Philadelphia, but I wasn't. No, I felt like I was being ushered through an assembly line of choosing the coffin. Do you want to upgrade? Do you want the add-ons? And pork barreling the process. And I was so vulnerable that I was just, like, the first time around, I was like, okay. And I just kind of went through it. And in the end, we got this bill, and talk about dark humor. I laughed for about 20 minutes when I saw how expensive it was. And, you know, when my dad passed away a few years later, I kind of was a little bit more emboldened because I had been put through the ringer. And I was like, you know what? We're going to do it our way. We're going to go, sorry, bad pun, but bare bones. And, you know, and we did the service the way we wanted it. We did the interment the way we wanted it. We did the unveiling the way we wanted it. And the way we wanted it was me actually not being there because it didn't provide me with that closure that they said would come after 365 days. On day 366, after losing my mom, I looked in the mirror and I looked the same. So with my dad, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go see a show and see something that I know he, that he like, and I would have shared.
What, think, what did you go see?
I saw, I'm trying to remember, I actually don't even remember, it was such a haze, but I remember that night I watched Singing in the Rain,
oh, really?
Which was one of our favorites, and then Guys and Dolls. And oh, I felt closer to him than I ever would have in some cemetery with a headstone that we just unveiled.
And for you,
actually,
yeah, Megan, go ahead.
Yeah, we actually did a funeral at home because my mother, sorry, didn't like funeral homes and didn't like the funerals we had been to. Two of my grandparents had died at that point. And so we had her cremated, which is what she wanted, and we brought her home and we did we had the funeral there within a very ad hoc – not ad hoc. We had a very – you know, people came over and they told funny stories about her. And we all went around and told stories about her from the oldest in the room, which was her mother, who was probably in her 80s, to the youngest, who was about 7. And it was, I think, exactly what she would have wanted. And it let us remember her in the round, you know, and in a kind of Irish wake style, which is, you know, after we told stories, everyone had some wine and told more stories, and they got more outrageous as the night went on.
That sounds like a fun funeral. But I wondered to you, Caleb, about a minute or so before our second break here, whether people tell other people what they want for their funeral, how they want to be buried, or if they want to be buried, or if they want to be cremated. All these details that the living have to try to figure out if you haven't had that conversation.
Yeah, we certainly need to. And I think there's an example in the media right now of a transgender woman who passed away, and her immediate family had her presented as a man at the funeral. And, you know, she was, I believe, 32. So didn't think about dying. I'm 33. I don't think about dying, although I'm a funeral director, so I guess I do. I see death
to the
all
job,
the time.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
Sure, but so it was never talked about. She never entrusted her funeral arrangements to somebody outside her family and unfortunately was entirely disrespected at her funeral. And it's very sad. And a lot of her friends were very upset. So we need to talk about it. This is a discussion that it's almost like the sex discussion. It's awkward. It's difficult at times, but it's a reality of our humanity. In fact, one of the deepest realities of what makes us up as human. And it's something that we need to broach and we need to talk about because we do not know when it's going to happen. And hopefully with that consciousness of our mortality, we can live life more fully.
And that's Caleb Wild, who joins us along with Rebecca Sofer and Megan O'Rourke. We are talking about death and dying in this hour of Radio Times. We have a lot of people that want to join our conversation, and we'll get back to our guests and to our callers, folks that have email comments and Facebook comments as well. And we'll be getting tweets at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about some of the changing rules and rituals around death and mourning and grief, and talking with, if I can say, a younger generation, changing some of these rituals and also personalizing them using the internet and social media and mourning and memorializing in much more public ways than probably their parents or grandparents did. And let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. Megan O'Rourke is a poet, a writer. She's the author of a memoir called A Long Goodbye. She's also a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, and joining us by studio there at Harvard. And with us here in our Philadelphia studio, Rebecca Sofer, co-founder, CEO of the website Modern Loss, full of candid essays and resources about loss and grieving. I should add, she's a former producer for the Colbert Report. And Caleb Wild is our third guest, sixth generation licensed and practicing funeral director and embalmer, working on a post-grad degree, and authors the blog called Confessions of a Funeral Director. We have a Facebook comment from Eliza saying, I don't use Twitter, but I posted news of my parents' death on Facebook hours after the death occurred. In both cases, the outpouring of support was incredibly helpful. It got me through those difficult days. Also, a comment on Facebook, Scott Simon tweeted about his mom dying, and Yvette on Facebook says, you know, thinks it was very well done. Are you seeing that, Caleb, more and more, the use of social media?
Yeah, I think social media is the new front porch. My grandfather's 83, and he still front porch sits with his dog, and people walk by, and it's he talks with them every night. He's kind of a fixture there.
Sits on the front porch, yeah, literally.
He does.
In person.
Sits on the front porch. And it's a small community. It's a small town, and that's how news spread, and that's how things conversations are started. And so we don't have those, you know, we're so mobile now and transient that Facebook, social media has become our front porch. And so we sit out there and we say what we need to say and people come by.
Yeah. Yeah. You agree with that?
I do. I agree with that. However, I think the internet is still this like wily place. It's the Wild West and we're still trying to figure out how to fit it into our lives, and it's fitting into our lives 24/7, whether we like it or not. So, you know, I certainly don't have any of the answers, but I do know that the technology has pros and cons in terms of grieving. I think that some of the pros are, you know, we wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today in the studio if we didn't have these very low touch ways of, you know, publishing content that reached out to people and made them feel less isolated. Which is wonderful. And I think that as your Facebook commenter said, you know, you have all the control in the world of what you put out there. You can ask people to bear witness to the fact that you lost somebody and you love them. And even years down the line, just make a comment and you can get this outpouring of likes and comments. But I think also the flip side is that it's kind of like a packet of sugar and refined sugar, because I think it's short lived. And I think that no like can replace, you know, a stiff drink or a hug. And, you know, I hope that we use the internet as kind of like a trigger for more meaningful in-person action instead of just texting or
a substitute,
you know,
for something more meaningful.
And I think by extension, it throws a wrench into the grieving process in the sense that people now die over and over and over and over again. You can be, you know, internet launches sneak attacks on you at 2 o'clock. You're in your cubicle. You open up Gmail. You want to send an email. And it says, hey, how about you add your dead mother to this message? Because you're used to emailing her. Or LinkedIn, you know, repeatedly actually asks me if I would like to add my father, who I could have sworn that I had canceled his account, but they still really want me to connect to him. And, you know, Facebook offers this unfiltered stream, and it's really hard to know where death fits in between, like, the latest small batch burritos and babies.
You want to weigh in on that, Megan? Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, first, I just want to say I got an email from my mother a year and a half after she died, and it was spam.
Wow.
But it was incredibly strange. I was at work. I was about to teach a class, and I opened my email, and there was an email from my mother. So it was totally bizarre. But I do want to weigh in. I think that the Facebook and social media phenomenon is a little more complicated. I think that – I mean, I agree with Rebecca that it's got its pros and cons. And I think it is the front porch, but it's doing something else too. And what it's doing that may be important and – also has its downside is that it's take what we've done in the 20th century and 21st centuries, we've psychologized grief, right? We've turned it into a purely individual, personal thing that you go through so that when you meet somebody on the street, they say, how are you? And the whole thing that makes it so fraught for everybody is that it's this one-on-one exchange where you have to say how you feel. And if you really tell them how you feel, you're going to kind of freak them out. But if you don't, then you're lying to them. And what Facebook does on the plus side is it creates an environment that sort of reminds us of the communal aspect of grief, right? When I put a comment on someone's Facebook page when their father has died, it's not so much a one-on-one exchange as it is that I'm part of this larger group.
Absolutely.
Right? And I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons that we're having more conversations about grief today, is that Facebook becomes a kind of safe place for those who are nervous or skittish or don't know what to say. And I think that's great. On the other hand, exactly as Rebecca is saying, that, you know, liking someone's Facebook status that their father died should not be your only.
I don't even know how.
Let me tell you, it oftentimes is. It is.
Just
you know,
thumbs up,
and oftentimes
right?
it is, and oftentimes it is, you know, but, you know, a card, a can I take you to a movie, you know, what I did a survey about grief on Slate. We had something like 8,000 participants. It was the largest survey of grieving that's been done, I think. And overwhelmingly, what people wanted in grief was recognition of their loss. And so Facebook can help with that, right? Because it can help on the anniversary. You know, you don't have to call your friends and say, guess what? Today's the anniversary of my mother's death, right? You can just post something and they'll respond. But on the other hand, what the survey showed is that often people want an in-person conversation where someone says, you know, I'm thinking about your mom. You know, do you think about your mother much? Right. They want others around them to mention the name of specifically the name of the person who's dead, right? And that's a really important thing, and we need to remember to do that.
Let me ask you kind of a crass question, Caleb. And in doing my homework for the show, I came across a number of references to this about the etiquette of doing selfies at funerals.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, is there a or do a don't on that, or does it is anything go?
Yeah, I don't know if. If that's something that we're going to see more and more of, and I think it does, it is certainly tied to different cultural expectations mm-hmm. and so forth. I mean, we'll find it at a funeral that's at one funeral, it's totally off limits. At another one, everybody's fine with it.
Right.
But you know, we say permission when it comes to photography. That's kind of the ethical baseline. Is that we need to look for. A head nod from the family or so forth. Yeah.
A comment from Pat. This goes to you, Rebecca, but probably to you, Megan, as well. A comment from Pat. She's touched on how lucky Rebecca is to have a mother that she cherishes so much. And that is the other side. I mean, it's you don't often feel that at that yes. moment, but over time you can look back and yeah. sort of see how lucky you are.
Yeah, I remember being, going to my therapist 6 months after she died, and my goal was not to cry on live radio, but is it Pat? Thanks, Pat.
Would not be the first time. I just want to tell you that. I have cried on the radio. So,
but, you know, I was talking to my therapist 6 months after she died, and I was saying, what is wrong with me? I'm still losing it. I'm still crying next to mariachi bands on the subway to Times Square and, like, walking up and down Broadway, just bursting into tears spontaneously. And he said, well, you know, how long has your mom been dead? And I said, 6 months. And he said, well, how many years did you have her in your life? And I said, 30. And he said, exactly.
There you go.
And it was kind of that moment that I was like, oh, I'm going to give myself permission to miss her whenever I damn well please, and which is every day. And some days it's more acute than others. And you're right. I am so lucky because I have met many people who have said, you know, I could live 60 years with my mom, and I wouldn't have the level of relationship that you had with her.
Megan, do you want to weigh in on that?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think that was one of the unexpected the things that was unexpectedly helpful about writing the book was realizing being able to memorialize my mother, and in doing so realizing, I mean, she was a really extraordinary woman. She was the person that you know, animals came up to and kind of put their heads in. She was just
how nice
that person.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? She just exuded trustworthiness and warmth. And that's why I miss her. And I realized at some point that, you know, grief is so often the flip side of love, you know, whether it's thwarted love or whether it's non-thwarted love. I mean, and I think that that's why humor and these other things are such a big part of it is that, you know, it's not something we want to get over because we don't want to get over love. And I was really lucky.
Indeed. Yeah. Let me read another email. This is from David. He said, I lost my wife in January 2014. We were married for 55 years. She suffered with MS. I was her caregiver for 30 years. The last 12, she was a quadriplegic, had to be tube-fed, etc. Mm-hmm. Mainline Health offers a great bereavement service in Radnor. With all my wife's problems, I grieve for her daily. I would gladly take her back in the same state. Yeah. Sort of picking up on what we were just talking about. But I'm assuming for you, Caleb, you hear this stuff probably every day or some version of what we've been talking about. And a darker side, I'm sure, too.
Yeah, sure. It's almost like walking into a foreign culture every time that we walk into a room where somebody's died because it's each time it's different. Each time we have to feel out what are the, who's the chief mourner, who What are the rules here? So there's a lot of observation, and and every time that we walk into it, it's us being super empathetic.
Yeah.
And feeling the room out. Obviously, we question a lot and so forth and ask people a lot of questions. But it's like walking into a foreign culture, because each death is different. So each grief is going to be different. Each situation is different.
Let me get Jessica from West Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for the show.
You're looking forward
to looking at the Modern Loss website. I lost my stepfather suddenly at age 73 in May, and we didn't know what to do for him for his funeral. We thought he might want to be buried. We're Jewish, and the funeral home showed us the Jewish section of the cemetery. But we didn't think that he'd want to be separated from the rest of the world in death, as he'd been separated as a young Jew escaping World War II. Wow. He made lots of connections as an environmental architect in Philadelphia, and the funeral home offered us the nature sanctuary part of the cemetery, which I'd never heard of. And as an environmental architect, we thought this is where he'd want to be. And even though there's no headstone, it's really wonderful to know that he's in a native forest, you know, without pesticides. It's just natural, and we can go there and remember him there. So that's what we decided to do.
And you're nodding your head, Caleb. And,
yes.
And I think you're on record saying that's how you would like to be buried.
Yes, yes, green burial. I think it's very healthy from a number of standpoints. You know, and what she's talking about, usually embalming is not allowed in a green burial. A vault is not allowed. And a vault generally costs upwards of $1,000 or more. It's usually a soft wood pine box or something that's going to decompose quickly. I think it's a healthy way. And, you know, we try to find immortality symbolism oftentimes in our death practices. But I think it helps us to embrace the finality of death when we allow nature to take its course. So, yeah, I would love to start one. I believe there's only 96 green cemeteries in the entire United States. And it's a lot more inexpensive. I think it's a lot healthier in the way that we embrace death. And I'm hoping that we see more and more as my generation begins to age.
We did a show a couple of years ago where people were, if they were cremated, their remains became part of a coral reef.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many, I know, that's interesting
nice.
ways. As you're all talking, I'm thinking both my parents died when they were 80, so I was sort of well into adulthood. But to this day, I have in my closet a madras shirt that my father wore endlessly and a pair of my mother's shoes because she was a walker. And so every morning when I open my closet, I can sort of see my little memorial to them. Are there things that you have done, Rebecca?
Oh, yeah. Well, the only person who knows this is my husband, but I guess now Greater Philadelphia is going to find out that the bathrobe that my mom always wore, I mean, I guess it's a little gross, but I never washed it. I mean, it was clean when I found it, but it is in the back of my closet, and it still has like a couple balled up unused Kleenex, you know?
Oh, wow.
I don't know, it just makes me feel good to have it, and sometimes when I really need it, I just wrap it around me.
Can you smell her? I feel like
she's hugging me. And
that's awesome.
I wish I could say I smelled her. I smell her less as the years go by, but I feel her spirit. I feel her energy. And with my dad, it's a an illustration. He was an ad man of two vultures talking to each other, and one is saying, "Patience, my ass, go out and kill somebody." So that encompasses my dad.
How beautiful is that? Megan, I'm going to give you the last word about 45 seconds before I have to say goodbye. Something for your mom?
Oh, yes. I actually have her bag, which I carry around, and a scarf of hers. And like Rebecca, I wrap myself in it, and I think of her when I need to. And it's a beautiful rainbow-colored scarf, so it's a little spot of brightness, and I kind of love to think of it and her that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a great pleasure having all three of you to join us today on Radio Time, talking about such an important topic. Megan O'Rourke, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a writer and a poet, author of a memoir called A Long Goodbye, and a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University. Rebecca Sulfur, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
A Philly girl herself, a co-founder, CEO of the website Modern Loss, and Caleb Wild, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marty. Yeah.
And he's a sixth-generation licensed and practicing funeral director and embalmer, and he authors the blog Confessions of a Funeral Director. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can download podcasts of the show. You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Quinn Libson, the intern this fall for Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.